Is the Nintendo Show 64, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet.
I can't really call it that.
Well, I'm gonna call it whatever I feel like calling it.
Briefly about 64 games.
Two N64 games I'm gonna talk about this time.
Yeah, but we're gonna talk about more about other things.
Like the Boondock Saints.
Yes.
So like the name implies, we usually talk about anything that came out 21 years ago, but mostly, partially, sometimes N64 games, as this is the retro show. But we're going to just take a look back to January of 2000 and reflect on it as a month in general. Because what a time to be alive it was.
I know, right?
In January 2000.
We just survived the scare.
Yep.
You know, Y2K wasn't really a thing.
And we just survived another scare recently.
That's true, but I mean, we don't want to spoil it for the listeners. 21 years, we'll tell them about it. Should we discuss anything topical with the current times?
No.
Just gotta let that hang.
We have a new president. That's it.
Okay.
Moving on.
Oh, thank God.
I think you guys are a bit more excited about this.
Big sigh of relief. This is for an After Dark. This is a different topic altogether.
We haven't had an After Dark in like a long time.
21 years.
21 years. This is 21 years.
So, side topic that's not American politics. What do we do when we get to the point, because we've been podcasting for 10 years, what do we do when we get to the point where we've podcasted for 21 years? Do we then reflect
on our own podcast? 21 years ago, we did this podcast. Do you even have, like, our first podcast? Like, do we have access to those early day podcasts?
Those must be rough as fuck.
I don't know how far back I have. I do have some very early ones.
I need you to find the earliest one you got.
I'll see what I can do.
And I must listen to Carlos just being a little bitch.
I don't know if I made the Carlos ones anymore.
Really? Well, those were, like, the first ones.
Yeah, but I'm... Like I was saying, I might have like episodes like 6, 7.
Let's face it, the show really started when you guys picked me up.
Right.
You know, it was like when they added Danny DeVito to the It's Always Sunny cast. You know? Well, you guys had a thing, and it was clearly that there was a good foundation, but you needed that spark.
Mm.
You know? That just the occasional off-color joke to really spice up your show. You know?
Right. We needed something to balance out Wes's racism.
Yeah, and his multi-level marketing thing that he keeps trying to pitch us.
Yeah, I don't want
anything to do with that, man.
I'm telling you, I have two friends. If you guys get two friends.
Yeah.
I was watching a thing about pyramid schemes. It might have been Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. But he was talking about, like, those pyramid schemes. Like, you find two friends, and you find two friends. And you get a guy on there who just, like, did some math. And it was like, by the time you get 15 layers in, you've exceeded the population of the planet.
What was that movie, Pay It Forward? Where it was a pyramid scheme, except about good deeds.
Right. It was Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, the kid gets stabbed at the end.
Jim Caviezel.
God.
Why did that movie, Tim?
I don't remember this movie at all.
It would do, yeah.
Really?
I'm aware of who those actors are.
Yeah. It's not a particularly good movie.
No, it's not.
No.
It's about a little kid who like came up with this crazy idea where if I did two things for two people and they did two good things for two people, then it spreads and everybody's doing good things. It like starts with a guy giving a jaguar away. Like,
oh, okay.
Not well, the that's, animal, that's... the car. Like,
oh. That seems fair enough,
yeah.
I guess. I don't know, it sounds like there was a movie like about...
And then spoilers, the kid gets stabbed and dies at the end.
Oh, well that sounds justified then. I already didn't like the kid.
Just like Haley Joel Osment in real life.
Yeah. Have you ever seen pictures of him as an adult? It's creepy how the kid's never aged.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably older than us. But he like, his face remained that. And he just became like a big, like, human being around that face.
Yeah, because he was in The Boys. He had a minor character role in The Boys.
Did he now?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, what? Man.
He was the psychic guy who...
Okay.
They're trying to find Kimiko's past. They're trying to communicate with her, so they tried to get a psychic to do it.
Interesting. Oh, I vaguely remember that. I kind of stopped watching. Well, there was because they only do like one episode a week or something, right?
I don't remember how they released it.
Because I didn't realize the whole series wasn't out yet, so I started like maybe 3 episodes or 4 episodes into season 2.
Okay.
And I haven't followed it up, but I need to.
Mm.
That's neither here nor there, nor is it occurring 21 years ago.
It did not. But there are some things that did occur 21 years ago that I think are worth talking about. We're going to start off with a game here.
Okie doke. That's what we're ostensibly supposed to do.
Good thing I can see the notes just clearly or in my field of vision.
Rayman 2, The Great Escape, came out on the N64. This was actually back in November. Had a bit of a blind spot there, but I went back. I got it. I own it now. I've played a bit of it. I'm not super deep in.
Does Rayman impersonate Steve McQueen at all? It's called The Great Escape.
Maybe when we get halfway through the game. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
This one developed and published by Ubisoft. It is a 3D platformer that started as a 2D platformer when it was originally in development. That seems to be pretty typical of 3D platformers of this era. It's like somebody had an idea for a game, a 2D platformer, and then they said, oh shit, 3D's a thing now. So then they started retrofit that game and kind of reimagine it in 3D. It is the second game in the Rayman series, which is the game that turned it into a series, I suppose. The first game was, of course, a 2D platformer. Like I said, I haven't played it a ton, but I can get into some of the nuts and bolts of the mechanics. It's actually structurally quite different from other 3D platformers that we've talked about on the N64. When you think of games like Mario 64, Banjo-Kazooie, Gex, if you ever want to think about the game Gex again. Rather than having like a large persistent level, like you do in Mario and Banjo-Kazooie, and have different goals to achieve throughout the level, what they do in Rayman is they break it into bespoke chunks. And you get like these transitions, like when you go through a door or into a cave, when you get to a new area. And there's a lightning quick load time. And rather than giving you like this big playground, like, hey, go and find stuff to do, it's like, no, this is a very specific platforming challenge. You get from point A to point B. So you do get that a more focused game on traditional platforming than other 3D platformers or 3D adventure games. Again, I'm thinking specifically of something like Banjo-Kazooie, Donkey Kong 64, where they just throw a ton of mechanics at you and say, here's all this stuff you can do. Just go and do stuff with it. So it doesn't overload you with mechanics, but it always finds new challenges for those mechanics. So just basic stuff here. You're, of course, running around. You run at one speed. You have your jump mechanic. When you jump twice in the air rather than doing a double jump, you get like these little propeller ears and you hover down at a slower rate. You can shoot projectiles out of your hands with the other face button. There's no melee attack. You're attacking everybody at range. And there's not really a whole lot of combat in the game. You control the camera with the C buttons like you would in Mario 64. It does have a nice inclusion, which is the down C button. Just automatically zips the camera behind you. And it's really smooth. It's just instantly the next frame, you're back behind the Rayman character, which is great. I think it's a really nice addition to a 3D platformer. And then you can also go into a first-person view if you need to take a look around. But rather than give you all this different stuff you can do, they start to mess around with sort of environmental mechanics, things like climbing on walls or bouncing on mushrooms. It's just hopping from platform to platform. It's more like a meat and potatoes platformer than we've seen in a lot of other platformers on the N64 outside of maybe Mario. And also when you do engage in combat, the Z button is a lock-on, as you would see in like Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
And when you lock on, you can then start to you strafe around the enemy rather than
Like
an Ocarina of Time, rather than moving in your 360 degree directions with the analog stick. I think that works out really well. And they so far haven't overloaded the screen with enemies. You're really only taking on one at a time here. I can't really get into too much about level design because, you know, I've only really played 45 minutes of this game, so I'm not sure where it's going yet and how it's going to grow as a platformer. I will say they do have a couple of interesting ideas using the character mechanics in different ways. There was one challenge where there was this big machine in front of me and a bridge leading to it, and I needed to get a bomb from one end to the other, and there's cannons firing at me, and I couldn't quite figure out what the hell I was supposed to do because it's an early 3D platformer, so there's haven't quite figured out how to teach mechanics without just giving you a splash screen with text. So what you're supposed to do is throw the bomb above you, shoot with the projectile the cannon blast that was coming at you, and then if you just stop shooting, he'll just catch the bomb automatically. which I think was a pretty neat idea. So I'm interested to see what sort of other ideas they can come up with. There's a lot to do in this game. It looks like there's a lot to do in this game. They have like these little glowy yellow dudes, like little fairies or something. And there are 1,000 of them in the game to collect, and they keep a running count for you. I probably won't be necessary to collect all of them, but I guess if you're going for that 100%, you got quite a bit you can go for. And these aren't like Power Stars or all the little tchotchkes in Banjo-Kazooie where you have to complete some sort of challenge to get them. So a lot of these things that I found are just kind of scattered throughout the level, and you just come across them by moving around. Something that else that I like about the game is they don't bother with this sort of messy hub level where you kind of meander around looking for your next goal. It's more like a level select, which I think is pretty cool. It's nice to have a game that just kind of presents you with your path forward, and you just figure out the platforming you need to do in order to get it. You don't go mucking about in these open levels wondering, you know, am I even going to the right place right now? So I grabbed this game used for like $15 on the N64.
That's not bad.
Yep. The cartridge is green, which is kind of cool.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, I see it over there.
This game got a ton of ports. It got ported over to the Dreamcast as well as the PS1 after the N64 version came out. It got ported to PS2. There's a DS version, a 3DS version. This game is available.
I see there's literally an iPod Touch version of it as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Turns out. So imagine trying to do that with like a touch interface. That's got to be fun.
Yeah, you know, it probably wouldn't be as much a nightmare as something like Banjo-Kazooie, Donkey Kong 64, these really mechanics-heavy platformers. You know, you could probably pull it off. Of course, not ideal. I don't think this is a good way to play a platformer, but it'd probably be passable.
So kind of a disturbing thing to think about with Rayman, right? Is that, you know, he has limbs, but they're invisible.
Right.
Right? So he wears the gloves and the shoes on his feet so you can kind of clearly see what he's doing with his body, right? What does that mean his face is?
Is he wearing a mask? Do you
think that's really his face? Yeah. Or do you think it's a mask?
Ooh.
Oh, so you think the guy's just invisible?
I think so, yeah.
Like just some kind of weird Kevin Bacon situation?
I'm willing to go with that it's just real hair. You know, and he's got
I'm okay with the hair.
Yeah, he's got a sweet kefaya. His scarf looks rather nice.
And it's interesting because like the
tactical scarf, though.
His limbs are also pliable because there are points like in the 2D platformer games where he's able to, he doesn't like shoot projectiles out of his hands, he actually launches his hands forward. And that's the projectile, yeah.
Well, maybe they're not projectiles, maybe it's stretchy arms.
Right, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like he's got to have like these pliable limbs.
Apparently I don't know the word pliable.
Flexible, moldable,
yeah.
Bendable.
Yeah, I got it now, okay.
So yeah, we'll see how I'm feeling about that game in a later show, if I'm able to keep on plugging away at it. But I'm not as repelled by this game as I have been other 3D platformers. Like when I was playing through Banjo-Kazooie, I could recognize I was playing something that was a good game, but it just felt like a chore to work through. Donkey Kong 64, I bounced off of almost immediately. There was not much fun happening right there. But yeah, so let's actually move into January now. On January 1st, and Ryan, you got some other things too that I don't have on my list. So
Absolutely. We'll
go through chronologically, and
I'll fill in when I seems like it's best appropriate.
What's the first date on your list?
I didn't really organize them by date.
Oh gosh,
but I think when we get to an event that happened January 4th, it will open up a couple of other topics.
Cool. So on January 1st, Fantasia 2000 was released in theaters.
Yeah.
Anybody care?
I got nothing.
Cool. Moving on. Next thing I got is January 4th, so I'll go with one and then you can tag in.
Okay.
On January 4th, we might have the same thing here. The day after signing as head coach of the New York Jets, Bill Belichick resigns and moves over to the Patriots.
Yeah, that's not what I had actually, but there's a couple of really big things that happened in the month of January involving the NFL this year.
Got anything to say about Mr. Belichick there?
Yeah.
Dropping one job to go to another?
This name sounds familiar. I don't know baseball, but this name sounds familiar. Who's this guy?
He's a football coach, yeah. Which I'm sure was the joke you were making, I hope.
His dad was Patriots. You're right. Yeah, I was not paying attention to that. Yeah. All right, sure.
Yeah. His dad was the coach of Navy.
Oh, is he still the coach?
He's still the coach.
Yeah, I know. He won
multiple Super Bowls.
I don't know that foosball game. I mean, I hear it's for the devil.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And the way that that worked out, it's really not like to hear both sides talk about it, Bill Parcells kind of presumed Bill Belichick wanted the job. And was sort of like grooming him to be his successor when he stepped down. Bill Belichick had other ambitions in mind and didn't want to follow in this guy's footsteps, wanted to do his own thing. So they sort of just presumptively named him the coach without really getting his 100% locked in approval. And then I believe at the time Bob Kraft had acquired the Patriots and he was looking for a coach and offered him the job, and he thought that that would be a better landing spot. And it obviously was
turned out to be right.
Correct decision on his part, because it would usher in a dynasty with him and Tom Brady, of course. And, you know, with all of these gaudy stats of, you know, winning football and the culture that he's created. I think more than anything else, that's probably the legacy that will live on with him. Yeah, there will probably be a footnote about the cheating stuff, but yeah. I think all of that is frankly overblown.
He goes to win a Super Bowl like the next year. Didn't they win in 2001?
Yeah, I believe it's... from 2001 to 2004, they won 3 Super Bowls.
Mm. How are they doing this year?
Terrible. Well, they're
done. Their season's over.
Yeah, they didn't make it to the playoffs, and they saw a division rival, the Bills, who we'll talk about in a minute, actually go to the AFC Championship game. The Bills are actually kind of on the rise, which is wild for them because they haven't achieved anything since... Like, you really have to think about it. It's like the Bills and the Jets. And the Dolphins, their entire franchises have been tanked for 2 decades because of this motherfucker. Mm. So there is so much bad blood out there for Bill Belichick that him having, like, for whatever reason, him having, I think the team went, like, 6-10, maybe 7-9, which is a good season for these other three teams most years. Most of the years, this is, like, better than they normally do. Like, so for them to see Bill Belichick have a year where he's, you know, doesn't make the playoffs is probably really fun. You know, the one year he didn't make the playoffs, I'm fairly certain this is right, the one year that he didn't make the playoffs, his team still went 11-5.
Oh, wow.
It was just one of those fluke years where there were too many good teams. Mm. And I think they were the second time an 11-5 team has not made the playoffs, either through taking the division or winning one of the 2 wild card spots. So, yeah, and again, the big thing that we should remember about Belichick is his, quote-unquote, do-your-job culture, where he sees so many times where players get down because a bad thing happens, and it's like, if you're on the defensive line and a cornerback gives up a big pass, that doesn't change anything about what you did. Like, I know it sucks that happened, but it wasn't your fault, and the cornerback can deal with it, too. The cornerback can learn from that and get better from it. That doesn't mean that you get to change how you approach. Like, always stay focused. If everyone does their job, we have a greater chance of winning. You know, take the ego out of your sport and just, you know, get to it and master your craft. He likes players that can do a lot of different things, so you'll see a lot of people really succeed. I mean, some name, not just Tom Brady, but like through the fucking 20 years of this organization, there have been so many fascinating players come and go. I mean, just a guy like Matt Slater. Wes is yawning.
Sorry. I've been up where I really...
It's amazing how many of these things happen in January of 2009.
I'll leave it at that. Like, I mean,
no, don't take my gun for anything.
Okay. But like,
other than his extreme boredom.
This is not, oh, God damn it.
Like, he made a special teams player, a guy named Matt Slater, a captain on the team. And special teams is often thought of as a relegated job for guys that barely made the squad. You know, he's taken a lot of these positions that are taken for granted and made them integral parts. He's part of rebranding the role of the tight end. I think that there were a couple of playmaking tight ends in the late 90s that are very important. Like a guy like Shannon Sharp. Shannon Sharp is sort of thought of as the current version of a tight end, but at the time he was thought of as... you know, not big enough, didn't block well, and he tried to catch too many balls rather than blocking too many people. So, but now that's like what every fucking tight end does. And Bill Belichick took advantage of that. Just a fascinating guy to look at in the history of the NFL. He'll be remembered as the greatest coach ever.
I mean, he's still coaching, though.
Still coaching, yeah. And I'm interested to see what happens, because they signed a one-year deal with Cam Newton. And Cam Newton, literally 3 years ago, was the MVP of the NFL. But he's clearly regressed. He's had too many injuries, I think, to be his former self. Oh, and this season also, they had like four of their most important defensive players choose to sit out the entire year. Because at the beginning of the year, players had an option to sit out because of COVID. And I think the Patriots had like 10 people, which is like double the next highest team for number of people choosing to sit out. A name that comes to mind is Patrick Chung. Patrick Chung's been a really important player for them for many, many years now. So they were already not bringing out their best team that they had available. They had a new quarterback because Tom Brady left for Tampa. So yeah, I think next year's
Tampa doing?
They're good. They're really good. They're going to be in the NFC Championship game against against Green Bay.
Screw that guy.
They already played once this year, by the way, Green Bay and Tampa did, and it was, I believe, the third worst game of Aaron Rodgers' career. And he's the opposing quarterback for Green Bay. So
thank you.
I'm really excited to see what happens. I certainly don't think it'll be a blowout, but who knows? Maybe it'll be a blowout. But Tom Brady is doing great. I think that...
Not just in football, but in life.
Yeah, man, he's crushing it. His wife makes more money than he does. Mm. She's a supermodel. He gets the banger every night.
I was sitting at Target the other day. We had these big TVs on, and they have like a reel that they change periodically. And I found out that Tim Tebow came out with a children's book. Weirdest thing. What's Tebow doing with the children's book?
Do you think he was intending to write a children's book?
Yeah, he's there, like promoting it.
Oh, that's so mean. He's like, I wrote a spy thriller. And then he brings it to them, and they're like, oh, this is great. There's drawings.
Oh shit, there's stickers. It was just weird.
You want to move on to some other NFL stuff that happened?
Let's do it.
An event called the Music City Miracle happens, which is you know that something awesome happened when there's a play, when there's like a name for a play. And this was a scenario in which this was the AFC Championship game between the Music City, of course, Tennessee Titans against the Buffalo Bills. Buffalo Bills had a 1-point lead with like 6 seconds left in the game, and all they have to do is kick the ball off and tackle the guy that catches the ball, right? Really standard shit. It ends up being, you could just watch the play and see how glorious this event is, but right, so the Bills kick it off thinking, okay, we're 6 seconds away from going to the Super Bowl. It gets caught by this guy who then immediately laterals it to another guy who then moves from left to the right side of the field, right? So what they call is like staying in your lane. You need to stay in your lane. So like all of the guys that are running downfield, they all move to the left to tackle this guy. He then throws the ball over to the left side of the field, creating this big open space to run.
Right, if they all move to the...
He basically slings the ball to the other side of the field because everyone over-pursued to chase that one guy. And then he just runs it up the sideline and into the end zone for a touchdown, and they win 22-16 in a walk-off touchdown.
Jeez.
Like
continuing the streak of Buffalo Bills futility.
Yeah, and the announcer's amazing because you just hear him and he's like, he's got it. I think he's got something. He's got it. And then he runs in the end zone and everyone's just losing their goddamn mind. They cut to this. Again, it was so beautiful watching this play happen again just because the stadium was full of like 70,000 people just losing their fucking minds. Really, really cool. And there's even a bunch of controversy about it as to whether or not it is truly... Because he makes this pass. He makes this probably like... 15-yard pass across the field, right? There's a lot of speculation as to whether or not that might have been a forward pass, and therefore that you can't do that. Yeah, it has to be essentially a lateral or a backward pass. You can throw it all the way across the field, but you can't.
You can't end up in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look closely, I think it's safe. They correctly made no call. It was a valid pass, but it is super fucking close. It has to be inches away from. Where the ball left to where it actually ends up when the guy catches it, and the guy even is almost dragging his knee on the ground. So we're like, oh man, just but it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's really cool that happens. The Bills, the hapless Bills, fuck, they get ruined again, man. Because they also, if you want to really do a little bit of time travel and go back, I think they had 5 years in a row where they made it to the Super Bowl. No, 4 years in a row they made it to the Super Bowl and lost every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the Bills are really a hard luck franchise. I think a lot of people would be very happy to see them make it to the Super Bowl this year. Which they could in theory happen.
They've I don't even know what state they go to.
Buffalo, New York.
New York. Yeah. Okay, good enough. It's almost Toronto. It's right at the border.
So they're almost Canadian.
Yeah, it's really. Trying to think of what else I had to say. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, that month is also when the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl itself happens. And it's the Rams end up going up against the Titans that just won this Music City Miracle, so they're going in hot. And the Rams win. Not by much. I think it's a really low-scoring game. But the Rams do ultimately win. And the MVP is the quarterback of the Rams, who's a guy named Kurt Warner.
Oh, sure.
Kurt Warner is fascinating because he is sort of this comeback guy. And again, literally 5 years prior to him winning that Super Bowl, he was a grocery bag guy. He had already played NFL, or he had already bombed out of the NFL and kind of came back into it later on. So literally 5 years prior to this, he didn't even have a career in football. He was literally a grocer.
Wow. So
wild rise for him.
So you're saying there's a chance for Tebow? Goes around writing children's books back to the NFL.
Back to the NFL.
No, I think basketball, though.
Yeah.
I think he tried baseball.
No, he's playing for the Mets. He's got to go.
Either that or maybe...
Reverse Jordan? Is that what's happening here?
He was such a sideshow when he played baseball.
I saw a competition recently where it was how many walnuts can you smash with your forehead?
Yeah.
Maybe he can do that. He's got a big forehead.
you got anything else, NFL?
No, those are the two big things.
Cool.
So I guess every January from now on, we'll get to talk about football game.
I guess we're going to have Super Bowl. Yeah. On January 12th, we got another movie. Next Friday was released in theaters. The sequel to the movie Friday.
I honestly don't even know if I've seen it. I've seen Friday, and I liked it.
I've seen the previews constantly.
For Next Friday? Or for Friday?
Both. Whatever one they lean and go, damn! Whatever that is.
What do they do?
That would
damn!
this is wonderful. But it is in fact Friday.
Is that Friday? Okay, good. At least I'm right on that. No, I was still wrong. I thought that was next Friday.
Chris Tucker and Ice Cube, I think, are the two in that specific scene.
Alright.
It's great. The original Friday is a super fun movie. It's very quotable. But I don't know much about Next Friday.
Neither do I. But a movie we do know something about because we just watched it.
Oh.
On January 21st.
Do you think Next Friday chronologically in story takes place the very next Friday after Friday?
I would hope so.
On January 21st.
Because there's a third one called Friday After Next. I'm serious. I'm pretty sure there is.
Oh, and then not Friday the 13th. That's the next one.
But that was like the third. That
where they all get murdered.
Jeez. Good Lord, calm down.
Boondock Saints came out in theaters January 21st, the year 2000. We just watched this.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
It's been years since I've watched it, and this is the first time watching it that I actually paid attention to it.
Sure.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie. You don't look like you did.
I had fun with the movie. The movie is a fun watch.
I mean, for someone who's had a poster on his wall of the Boondock Saints for years.
Yeah, you know what? We've all been 22 and had posters in our lives, all right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you really wanted to just put it on a fucking...
You still got that poster somewhere, don't you?
I think that's it right there.
Is that it right there?
Oh, God.
Oh, shit. We're looking at this. On air, I'm walking over to take a look at this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Move in and ruin that whole thing.
If you wanted to take a jab at this movie, you would say it's the frat boy take of Quentin Tarantino.
It is. That is it. That's the Boondock Saints poster.
Well, John, is that your most shameful thing? I mean, I'm sure you've got.
No, probably not. I'm sure there's a dildo some lying
video
on here somewhere.
Game in here, perhaps. No. Yeah, I think that's really what it is. This amounts to. It's a dumbed down, jock take of what Tarantino was trying to do. With making kind of edgy grindhouse films.
Yeah, because it does have that sort of tone of, it has this irreverent tone and also very, grotesquely violent at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't think it quite has, the same sort of pop culture fixation that a Tarantino movie would have. They do mention Charles Bronson at some point.
Yeah.
When they're in that guy's just, side room that has all these guns in it that the police have never found for some reason.
But you know what else does? True Romance?
Yep,
true. Which is a Tony Scott film, I believe I want to say that is also written by Tarantino.
Yes.
And there literally is a line where... Oh, shit, it's what's-his-face?
Christian Slater?
No, no. He's the drug dealer. Gary Oldman is in. Mm. And remember that he's a drug dealer guy with the freaking dreads or whatever? And he's like, we got Charlie fucking Bronson over here. You know, he literally even mentions that because Slater comes in with a fucking gun. So, and again, I think that if there is any one film this movie feels a hell of a lot like, it's like you took True Romance and then, you know, made it less good. Made it much more Irish themed and less good.
Yeah, it is also very fetishized in the sort of like Irish Boston sort of region.
Which Departed, another crime film set in Boston, manages to handle it with a little more grace, if you dare say, a little more, I don't know, more subdued, a little more eloquence.
Yeah, he gives his two main characters, played by Norman Reedus of Walking Dead, as well as
Sean Patrick Flannery of Saw 3.
Yeah. he gives...
Oh, what a legacy.
those two characters who are from South Boston, living in South Boston, he gives them just Irish accents. He has them talking like these. He's like very, like, Lucky Charms.
Yeah, it's true. There's definitely... I mean, I think a lot of the people that are in it are Irish. Isn't Norman Reedus Irish?
Sure, maybe.
You know, I would assume a guy named Sean Patrick Flannery is Irish. Sean, yes.
He's like fucking Dutch.
Yeah, I mean, and the only one that... I don't know if Willem Dafoe... I don't think Willem Dafoe is Irish, but he shouldn't be Irish. He's the one outsider of the whole clique of all of the people in it.
Billy Connolly shows up.
Yeah.
This movie does not have very many women.
No, but it's three.
Yeah, the movie itself is.
I mean, are we counting Defoe in this or not? Like, because of that ending part, are we counting?
I love that. That's the one thing to say about this movie is that it's like the most fucking quotable movie ever. I mean, he's like, I love that Irish. Like, I fucking killed your cat, bitch. I thought it would bring closure to our relationship.
It does have a lot of fun with people screaming at each other, like these dialogue exchanges. I think, you know, for as problematic as the movie is,
it starts with them beating
it's a fun watch.
It starts with them beating a woman during the opening credits.
Yeah, I mean, it sure does.
In their defense, though, she did like wail on his nuts. So I mean,
yeah, she did, you know, she took the first swing, I guess, but.
I mean,
but she was not depicted in a positive light
at all.
Just like this typically very like butch. Probably homosexual woman. I don't think we have very much confirmation of that, but anyway.
Oh, so I guess that is the premise of the movie, right? It's basically like two Irish guys go on a killing spree specifically targeted at non-Irish people. Right, criminals, mind you.
They're initially going after,
the wicked, blah, blah, blah.
They stumble into a murder where they take out a couple of guys who are involved in organized crime and then continue this murder spree, specifically going after people involved in organized crime, specifically like Russians and Italians, when they themselves are kind of this Irish mafia.
Yeah, again, that was the one thing I was going to say about it, is like, you never see them pick on the Irish mob, which I'm sure exists, you know? So it's sort of like they're going after...
They'll get to it.
And there is this glorification of violence, and they try to play it off through this lens of, like, well, they're trying to do something righteous here. And I think, like... toward the end when they have that courthouse scene and then like the man on the street interviews during the credits, they kind of like try to pull it back into this gray area, like, are they doing the right thing or not? But the entire movie,
it doesn't deserve
it all up for laughs, so it doesn't earn any of that.
It doesn't deserve the debate. I mean, there is a debate to have that is said between justice and vengeance. You know, if harming someone, like the death penalty, if you kill someone, it doesn't solve anyone's problems.
Right, it's retribution.
Yeah, it's vengeance, it isn't justice. And I mean, people have their opinions about the death penalty, whatever, that's not my point. But this movie, in the end, it tries to say that that's what it's about, but I don't think that that's what this is about.
No, this is about people telling jokes after you see a murder scene. And they're, Wes, go ahead.
What are you going to use this rope for?
No, I mean, it's a very weak story and everything, but it's just wacky goofiness.
And I think, like, the way they play it up for laughs, they do with some success, like you were saying, because it's a very quotable movie. And I think just the way that they structured the movie through editing also, you don't ever have to deal with any sort of tension. You're always seeing the aftermath of what they've done and Willem Dafoe figuring it out before you actually see them execute it. Execute their executions.
I think it makes it so much more watchable to do that, too. Like, if you were to watch this through... in the order of events as they happen chronologically, what you would see is a brutal moment of violence where they're yucking it up, to a detective then trying to solve the thing.
And telling you exactly what happened, yeah.
It actually does kind of create a little air of mystery when they're, like, showing you what the detective sees before seeing the actual events, or kind of, like, partially knowing how the events played out. So, yeah, that's good. I'm glad they did that. That's actually some clever, dare I say, clever editing. Like, way to present the story.
Yeah, I think it's to the film's credit. I think that there is just a complete lack of any sort of characterization or character arc or growth.
Oh, yeah, there's none.
These two guys just have this epiphany, like, hey, we need to kill other people, and then they are the exact same at the beginning of the movie as they are at the end.
Yeah. Well, also, it's the character Rocco. In a lot of ways, he's the one that drives a lot of this, because if you remember, like, he was going to get set up too, so he kills some people, and then he then leads them to other people that they're going to kill, because they then want to take down basically the Russian mafia.
Pretty much.
So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it works.
No,
yeah,
but it was a firefight.
Yeah, there was a firefight. And as he is shooting his own gun off. Like, by the way, what Willem Dafoe does in this movie
is the best.
Is a genius. Like,
oh, he's committed.
Oh, Willem Dafoe in this movie is like, I said this while we were watching it too. Willem Dafoe in this movie is Sinbad and Jingle All the Way.
He steals
the movie and just makes it.
That's what somebody actually read. I was reading some comments about this, and someone said that he's like, I don't know what Willem Dafoe is doing it, but he's doing it 1,000%. Like, he's just going. He is fucking off the rails. Yeah, you gotta love that, like, and again, he's a change of pace. He's the one that's the fish out of water or whatever. He's the one that's not really of that environment.
Yeah, he's the outsider that you rightly latch onto, because he's taking you on this journey.
Oh, and his interactions with the actor's real life name is Bob Marley.
Yeah,
but it's not the Bob Marley, of course. He's a comedian, but he's the shitbag cop that he gets paired up with
the huge fucking guy.
Yeah, right.
So, what a bagel.
Now we got a huge guy theory and a serial crusher theory.
Yeah.
Well, like the people you're supposed to be following, like. Norman Reedus, Sean Patrick Flannery, Rocco, whatever the actor's name is.
His last name these guys is, in fact, Rocco.
Aren't doing anything but satisfying some sort of, like, audience bloodlust. If you want to see some people get shot, and most of them don't deserve it, like, there you go. These are your guys.
Oh, maybe a movie like Falling Down. Like, Falling Down is a great movie. Joel Schumacher made it. Like, I mean, he's a very bipolar director. But, you know, you kind of get to see Michael Douglas play a guy who kind of realizes that he's in a dead-end job with a life he doesn't enjoy. And he just wants to take it out on some motherfuckers. And that's why it's called Falling Down. You're watching this guy just descend into madness. And it's disgusting and brutal, and in its own weird way, it's viscerally enjoyable for the audience. And I think that this is so fucking camp. Mm. It plays it so hard for laughs that it doesn't even give you the room to have that genuine grossness to it all, because it's just like you're not even supposed to take it seriously.
And I was thinking about another movie that came out that we talked about a few months ago, Bringing Out the Dead, with the Nicolas Cage directed by Martin Scorsese one. During the 90s, the late 90s, and this movie was made in the 90s and then released in January of 2000. There's this very harsh, incorrect view of crime, specifically crimes of poverty, where there's like it's just viewed as like this grotesque thing that needs to be stamped out, and you see it very blatantly in Boondock Saints, where they're just going around killing people who they view as immoral, and they specifically mention, oh, then we're going to go after drug dealers and pimps. Like, crimes are only crimes because of a distorted justice system that views there's only violence in those sort of fields because of the illegality of it.
Right.
It just kind of compounds on itself.
We talked about that off air. Like, where if, like, if prostitution was legal, there would never be pimps.
Right. There would be no need for pimps. They could
unionize
and run themselves.
Yeah, you would cut down on child sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of benefits would happen. The only thing is that people think it's icky.
You're pro-prostitution.
I think a man or woman has, if they're consenting adults, they have a right to exchange money to have sexual intercourse. Fine, do it. Like, if you can make a buck doing that, nice work if you can get it. That's my theory on that, honestly. Like, quarterly prostitution should be legal. Again,
yeah, the only reason that there is a stigma and violence associated with that the world's oldest profession is because of the illegality of it. If it weren't illegal, you wouldn't have to have women walking the streets at night, possibly getting assaulted, or you wouldn't have to have enforcers going after people to get the money that the women are owed.
Yeah.
You would have a union of women, and, you know, men, if anyone wants to pay to have sex with a man, sure, why not?
Yeah, women should have the right to do that. I'm sure there's probably a ton of women that would love to do that.
And we need to make companions from Firefly. That's what we need.
I mean, that's essentially, yeah, you get to pick and choose your own customers. Like, you have the right to refuse service if you don't want to fuck that person. And then your enforcers become the criminal justice system. If somebody leaves without paying, like, well, then you've committed a misdemeanor and now you have to pay a bigger fine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is obviously the solution. It's the same with, like, recidivism with drugs and stuff like that, where, you know, you arrest someone for some kind of petty drug crime, and then rather than getting them clean, you just put them into a system that trains them how to be criminals.
Mm. Yeah, it's treated like you have, whether, you know, it's an addiction or a possession, or somebody just made a mistake one time, you become stigmatized, and rather than acknowledging you have an addiction, you have a sickness, it's like, you have an addiction, you are a criminal.
So yeah, again, like, what really is wrong about prostitution if it's consenting adults?
Right.
And again, like, what is it ruins the foundation of marriage? Like, I would assume 90% of cheating spouses are not cheating with prostitutes, they're fucking their neighbor's wife.
Mm.
Right?
And the foundation of marriage, as it existed before, it was already ruined.
Yeah.
You know, things were not perfect before prostitution.
I actually saw a really neat video a little while ago of someone talking about the film Adam's Family Values and talking about it as a masterpiece for, like, the LGBT community and for people that would identify as queer. And again, poking fun at the family values, which is just coded language that conservatives use to suppress the rights of women, minorities, and the transgender, or LGBT community at large.
Mm.
You know, whenever you hear a politician talk about family values, what they're meaning is a oppressive male hierarchy where they're at the top and everyone is subservient to them.
Yeah, and if that's the foundation of marriage, then broken from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what else happened in 2000?
In 2000?
Boondock Saints!
Are we already
done with this one?
Thumbs up or thumbs down to Boondock Saints?
It's nothing crazy. I mean, it's not an amazing film. It's still fun to watch. I mean,
okay,
it's a little cringy at times, but man, it's so funny.
Willem Dafoe alone is worth watching that movie just for those Willem Dafoe scenes.
Yeah. I think it is problematic but highly rewatchable. Thumbs up.
Yeah.
January. I got some video games. You got anything else you want to jump in with before we go into?
Maybe I'll just throw in a thing here or there. Steve Ballmer becomes the CEO of Microsoft in the year 2000, in January of 2000, stepping in for Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Ballmer is a bigger name now, probably not from that as much as it is the fact that he owns the Clippers. There was a big thing with this guy Donald Sterling that made some really racist comments and was in fact a racist person. So they deemed it inappropriate that he owns a team that, you know, largely employs black people. So he was,
or, you know, or is involved as an influential person in society at large.
Yeah, it's good way to put it. So he ended up selling the team, and Steve Ballmer's deep ass pockets were like, "Yeah, I'm fucking buying that." His net worth, I believe it says here on Wikipedia, is $43 billion.
My goodness,
the Clippers? Billion.
No, just that guy.
No, it's just Steve Ballmer who owns. That's part of his portfolio. I'm sure it's a giant chunk of Microsoft stock as well.
Yeah. What the fuck, the Clippers? Like, I was about to lose my mind over that.
I mean, NBA franchises are worth a ton.
You're outraged that the Clippers cannot be worth $40 billion, but that one guy can?
I mean, he's got Microsoft.
Okay.
It makes sense.
Mario Party 2 comes out on the N64 on January 24th, 2000.
I remember this game. This game was a gem.
Remembering
it as a child, this game is a gem.
Do you remember many of the differences between Mario Party 1 and 2?
Not at all.
Okay. It was developed by Hudson.
Because I did play 1.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Developed by Hudson Soft, rest in peace, and published by Nintendo. Just as for context, Hudson Soft made a few Mario Party games, and then I believe in the mid-aughts was bought up by Konami. and Konami destroyed them. This is a real quick follow-up to Mario Party 1. Mario Party 1 came out in February of 99, so we're looking at less than 12 months later. Here comes a sequel.
Wow.
Mario Party 3 is coming in May 2001, so we're looking at three back-to-back-to-back years of Mario Party games on the N64.
Well, they were really popular back then, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, Mario Party 1 was really popular. Mario Party 2, also very popular. I'm not sure how Mario Party 3 fared, being out so late in the N64 life cycle. But, you know, then the series goes on to get three more sequels on the GameCube and then the Wii. And here we are with, I think, like the 11th iteration, maybe 12th, on the Switch now.
Yeah, but we're probably only going to get that one on the Switch.
You would hope so. You'd think, at this point now, if they wanted to add to Mario Party, which they haven't. They haven't made any sort of changes
same,
to that game.
It's the same fucking game.
I mean, just the Switch version in general. They released the game, and then that's it. They haven't done any sort of updates or anything, which is weird, especially for a first-party title like that. At this point, if they wanted to add to Mario Party, they could just do it through DLC rather than developing a whole new game, printing it, shipping it out. They could just, like, here's $20 or some extra boards.
But, idea.
Go on.
Culturally inclusive Mario Fiesta.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. I'd be down.
You know, maybe like incorporate Spanish culture.
Uh-huh.
You know, find a fun way to spice this whole thing up. And Odyssey, doesn't he get a sombrero?
I'm not sure if he does in Mario.
Pretty sure he gets a sombrero.
In Mario Party 2, they do get different costumes depending on what board they're on. There's definitely a cowboy and a pirate, and I think also a space outfit.
I like this.
There are six different boards, and all of them have different outfits except for the Bowser level. And the Bowser level, they're all just in their standard garb. And even Bowser gets like different costumes. When he shows up in the cowboy level, he's wearing the cowboy hat just like everybody else. He's in on it.
So you're talking about a new Mario Party game, except it's Mario Fiesta.
Yes.
So you want them to do, like, the Pokemon thing, except now it's different regions of the world.
I'm cool with that. Yeah, totally. That'd be sweet.
Well, Fiesta could, like, be so many parts of the world, though.
Yeah.
That's true. Every nation has like, some yeah. South American stuff and some Caribbean stuff.
Yeah. It said that I just want them to bring back Dokapone Kingdom.
Oh, I love Dokapone Kingdom.
It just have all the regions of the world in one board. And just being incredibly racist in every single one of them.
They're not above it.
If there's one thing we can count on people being able to do, it's being culturally insensitive.
Yeah, ni hao. I mean, it's just...
I forget. I think I was grilling you about something in Pokemon when we last did our Pokemon thing. And you actually kind of... I was being an asshole and going off the rails as I normally do. But you chimed in with something that is kind of a valid point, which was to say that... We're from America, so we have a much more closer relationship with England, or at least we think we do, or at least we feel like we're culturally a little more included in what they do, than the Japanese. So we're watching the Japanese lens interpret what they think England is, or something like that. And it's like, maybe there's a little bit of truth to that.
So
like,
they are silly. We're like looking into a mirror from another mirror. Because yes. We think we're like looking at ourselves when we look at England. And, you know, I think there is a certain like a kindred relationship yes. between us and England. But maybe not as close as we think it is. We'd have to get their opinion on that. But then we're like looking at Japan, doing their version of them, and like thinking about like, okay, how this is what you think of them? Because it is wildly different from what we think of them.
Yep.
There's, like I mentioned, it's more Mario Party. Mario Party 2. It does not have the blister-inducing minigames where you have to spin the flimsy analog stick.
Ugh.
There was at least a lawsuit involved with Nintendo and a class action suit to get replacement controllers or something because broken controllers and injuries, in quotes, because of the blisters.
So silly.
Well, you know, you can sue about anything.
Is there a class action lawsuit about the drift on the Joy-Cons?
There is a class action lawsuit. It is ongoing. Wow. Which is why when you ask Nintendo about Joy-Con drift, they say they can't comment on it because there's legal proceedings. They're litigating.
I mean, they're fixing it though.
They are, yes.
I mean,
you can still send them in. I don't know if they're still fixing them for free, but yeah, you can still fix your Joy-Con if they get drift.
Yeah. So I mean,
interesting.
So, like I mentioned, six characters, six boards. Characters dress up according to the theme of the board. There are 65 minigames, which I think is pretty impressive. For such an early game. Mario Party 2 introduced the 1v1 minigames before, like, had to be four people involved. in some form or fashion, whether it's 1v3 or 2v2. There's also a single-player mode where you can play through all of the mini-games, if you so choose.
Sounds like fun. WarioWare style. Just blast through them all.
Mm-hmm. You can get a used copy of this going for about $30 on Amazon. It did get a digital release on both Wii and Wii U Virtual Console. You can't get it on Wii anymore. That Virtual Console is shut down. And as of right now, you can still get it on Wii U. If you want.
I'm sure they're making dozens of sales a year.
Yeah, well, Mario Party is one of those series like where if you own one that was released in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, you probably don't need another one anytime soon.
Yeah.
I think it's cool to have them every once in a while, but you know.
I honestly love playing them. It's one of those games where you kind of like grow to hate the people you're playing with, you know?
Like Monopoly.
It gets super vindictive. Yeah. Yeah, actually, a lot like Monopoly.
Yeah,
it's true.
And then, like, much to its source material, which is board games, there's a lot of luck involved with your dice rolls and just, like, the sort of random events that will pop up.
Yeah.
I don't know how early on the sort of, like, judgment system happens in Mario Party, but modern Mario Party games will sort of try to, like rubber band you, where if you are doing poorly, they'll just give you better dice rolls. They'll, like, at the end of the game, if you're in last place, they'll kind of try to come up with some sort of rewards. Like, hey, you move the least amount of spaces, you get a star.
Yeah. That's like the blue shell logic, I guess.
Mm.
That's supposed to, like, help the worst, but also hurt the best.
Yeah.
And I feel like that happens almost every game, honestly, where someone feels like they got jobbed. You know, where it was like, oh, this person kicked my ass the whole thing, and then they just get wrecked for some arbitrary reason because of the game's logic. But
the game Wes was mentioning earlier, Dokkan Kingdom, it did that exact thing. If you kind of became in the lead, the game would then actively try to work against you in terms of like random encounters and events so that other people started to catch up.
And even the person that was in the last place, if they're in last place too long, they can become a Darkling and just ruin the entire board for everybody.
Yeah, you can get a special character, like just a troll class.
That was a wacky game. I thoroughly.
Is that the equivalent of like the person in the racing game that just turns their car in the other direction and starts trying to run headfirst than everyone else they're playing?
Speaking of games that you spend a lot of time in cars,
hey,
Crazy Taxi released
Segway
on the Sega Dreamcast in North America.
Yeah.
You guys have played Crazy Taxi, yes?
I have.
Yeah, who hasn't?
I do not understand the love that people have for this game.
I mean, I don't understand the love of it. It's a fun little game.
Okay.
It's fine.
Do either of you guys
I'm not going to play for extensive hours. Like, I play for like 20 minutes. We're like, all right, that's enough. Move on with life.
Zero invested, but it's the greatest game ever. No. I couldn't even tell you the last time I played it.
Mm. Every time like I hear this game get brought up on, you know, different podcasts and such, it's like, oh man, I love Crazy Taxi. I don't quite understand why. It's a lot of...
Probably because they're dumb.
Maybe because they're dumb.
It's the same thing over and over and over again.
Stop here, and then drive over there. And then stop there, and then drive over there. And I guess, like, the fun is in, like, the wackiness of it, where you can, like, run people down or something, because it's just crazy fun to run people over with a car.
I mean, I remember enjoying... I'm sure it's not a very, like, great, like, fun game to revisit, but I played those Carmageddon games and enjoyed them. Twisted Metal was kind of like a combat car game, which was fun. Carmageddon was like totally about just like killing pedestrians.
Okay.
The map would be populated with like 100 people, and you had to run them over with Simpsons your sick hit and car. yeah, you know, that's fine. Whatever. I don't know. I mean, literally, like GTA, you could do that. Like Grand Theft Auto 3, that was a thing where you would be rewarded for completing taxi missions. And honestly, with as crazy and violent and crime-riddled as that game is, it's sometimes kind of fun to just do the jobs, like be an ambulance driver and save lives, you know, be a taxi driver and just, like, you know, drop people off.
Just drive really carefully. Obey all the traffic laws.
Yeah, it ain't the worst thing that's ever happened in a game. But yeah, no, I really don't remember much about Crazy Taxi. Like, I had a Dreamcast back in the day, so I probably had a burned disc of this, but I don't recall playing it.
Ryan, you got anything you want to do for music before we close it out here?
A couple of things. What's up?
I say close it out. We still got a little bit to go here. But okay. So we're rounding out the chronological events.
I think I somehow missed bringing this up, too, when we were talking about basketball. But the actual thing that happened in basketball, not just that Steve Ballmer he became the CEO of Microsoft. This is also when Mark Cuban acquired ownership of the Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating.
I didn't know they were a team.
They won a title, I want to say, in 2009. And this was when they had Dirk Nowitzki on the team. And they beat the, I think it was the first year that LeBron James had gone to the Miami Heat. So he teamed up with Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this whole thing. Everyone was just kind of presuming that the Heat were going to crush the Mavericks. And the Mavericks won in like five, really just beat their ass. But yeah, his net worth is only $4 billion. Would you believe that?
He's got some catching up to do.
Sure does. But yeah, Mark Cuban, interesting fella. So that happened. As we do every January, well, most of us do, we celebrate Martin Luther King Day.
Yep.
And the reason why I wanted to, this came to my attention, was that in the year 2000 was when the last state that didn't acknowledge Martin Luther King Day acknowledges it.
It's horrifying that it took to the year 2000 to do that.
You forget just how racist our nation is, like, in the history of things.
I try to forget.
You wish you could.
I mean, in reality, there's probably states nowadays doing it, and they're doing it reluctantly. I mean, just...
Yeah.
They're doing it for PR purposes. I mean, they're just...
Here's what some states did, and they thought this was for PR purposes. So, I was going to ask you what state it was, and I think the first... John, you just presumed Alabama, because good guess. But not correct. Here's what fucking Alabama did, and a number of states did this. It's so disgusting. Do you know who Martin Luther King Jr. shares a birthday with? Robert E. Lee.
Oh, God.
Oh, shit.
So it became a shared Robert E. Lee Martin Luther King Memorial Day. How fucking horrifying.
My God.
Wow.
You know, just as one sentence, and then we'll get back to that. You know what pisses me off about Robert E. Lee is when you're, like, in school, especially if you go to school in the South, the thing that they say is, like, oh, Robert E. Lee was nice to his slaves. You know what would be nice to his slaves? If he fucking gave them a paycheck or let them fucking go. That would be the nice thing to do.
That would be the nicest thing he could have done. Yes.
Anyway.
Not owning them in the first place.
Right.
Yeah, not believing that, one human is less than another.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, any guesses on what that state was?
The last one to admit
Maine.
To?
I don't know.
Yeah, in 2000, what state did this? Not Maine. It was not Maine.
That would be a holdout.
Yeah, I know, right? Like up north? Yeah, exactly.
My turn? All right. Jeez.
I'm going to go with Georgia as my actual guess.
Okay. What's your actual guess? Is it also Georgia or is it something else?
No, I don't. I was thinking about Georgia, but I don't think I was going to land on Georgia. I am going to say Arkansas.
Neither of those. What if I told you the name Lindsey Graham?
Oh, South Carolina.
In fact, it was South Carolina.
Oh, yeah, that actually makes sense.
That does make sense, yeah.
Man, the place that brought us.
The Confederacy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, and apparently, I'm just now reading this here. They still have three Confederate holidays on the books, so don't worry. Holy shit, they're so fucking
wouldn't that
racist.
Be like the same as if we celebrated, and I don't mean to say that Canada's a racist nation, but if we either celebrated Canadian holidays, like, you're celebrating the holiday of another insurrectionist country. Like, you don't live in the Confederacy. It's not a real place anymore.
I mean, as someone that works in the financial markets... I think we should celebrate every other nation's holidays because it means I don't have to do that fun that day. So I'm totally on board with us celebrating every other holiday you can imagine.
So Robert E. Lee's birthday, you're on board.
I mean, I'll be ripping him okay, but John, do it however you want to do it. It's America after all. So yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, music. I had a whole list of musical stuff here as well that I thought would be interesting to talk about. So... some big albums that came out. Modest Mouse released an album called Building Nothing, which, unless you're a fan of Modest Mouse, it's just another album, and they're
like Modest Mouse
records, but very good records.
I can't recognize the record. I don't know their records, but I do like Modest Mouse.
I believe this is the one that has Dramamine on it, which is like, as the song would imagine, very, very mellow.
I'm Modest Mouse agnostic.
Yeah?
They probably exist, but I'm not convinced.
Are they Canadian?
Maybe.
I don't know. A band that I really like called Explosions in the Sky came out with their first record called How Strange Innocence. Explosions in the Sky creates... They didn't invent the sound, but they certainly helped popularize a sound called post-rock. And what post-rock is using guitar, bass, and drums in a way that doesn't make rock and roll music. Essentially what they're doing is making much more cinematic and atmospheric music where they're... Songs maybe 10 minutes long, and they're slowly building up to these big moments with kind of just beautiful chord progressions and tons of layered distortion. Post-rock really hit it big in like the aughts, or I guess from the year 2000 to probably 2010. It was a genre that kind of blew up with a lot of really popular bands coming out of that. Or at least in, popular within the realm of indie music. And again, just kind of a sign that people can have more diverse tastes. I like that a lot. All the Small Things by Blink-182, they released that single on January 18th. It's a big one.
Yeah, it's a big one. They were quite popular for a while.
Yeah, also competing with Destiny Child's Say My Name, another huge song.
Yeah.
Red Hot Chili Peppers released that bummer downer track, Other Side.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, and the band Him, I don't know if you remember them, released an album called Razorblade Romance.
I don't remember that.
In which they do a cover of that song, was it I Want to Fall in Love or something. Him is like, the band should have come out like 10 years after they did, because like, this is the band that represents like the vampire that like beats his girlfriend and drinks her blood. You know, like that would be akin to something like Twilight, or you know, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer series and shit like that. You know, that kind of like gothy edge guy that the girl can go for. You know, even though he's dangerous and again is going to like violate her.
But she can change him.
Yeah, right? That's who Him is. Like, I mean, look at him. This is the guy. This is what's going on here.
Oh, he just looks like a douchebag.
Yeah, right? He straight up looks like, you know.
Holy hell.
Yeah, he's not asking permission. He's just,
I think he needs a longer necklace.
So, yeah.
He's the reason why we don't have prostitution as illegal.
Yeah. I mean, there's other bands here that I think are interesting, but I think that those are the big hits. The big hits of January 2000.
Cool. Well, to round out the month here, we have a couple of things that happened on January 31st. Ray Lewis might have murdered those people.
We start with football and we end with football. Isn't that the thing about it? Yeah, he kind of might have done that.
Yeah, he could have. There was at least a person of interest in a murder. He might have killed some people. And we all just kind of forgot because he could play football. Well, we didn't totally forget. We chose to ignore.
Well, and he's practically like a self-help spokesman, too. Like, he's such a, again, in the same way that Belichick is very much like a do-your-job thing, like, Ray Lewis is like, he's the guy in the trenches that gets everyone to run at the machine guns. You know, that's kind of that's who Ray Lewis is. He's the pump-up guy. He gets you fucking going. And
the hype man.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. So, yeah.
It's for murder. I don't
get hyped for murder.
Yay. And as I understand, if I remember the events correctly, and I may be totally off, I don't know if you did any research on this, but as I understand it, he was at a club with some friends. There was an altercation that resulted in someone being stabbed to death.
Couple people
being stabbed to death. He may or may not have held a knife, and he certainly did drive away with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, he either is an accessory to murder or a murderer.
Yep.
And I don't know the circumstances by which he...
Both cases would make it so he doesn't play football. I mean, at what point do you go, sure, come back on the field?
But that Pete Rose, though, what a monster.
Yeah, how dare he?
Made some prop bets. Piece of shit.
Alright, anyway, also on the same day, Marvel vs. Capcom was released on PS1. It had previously come out on Sega Dreamcast, and now it is coming out onto the PlayStation 1.
I love that game. I love the whole franchise so much.
We talked about the roster back when it came out on Dreamcast. We talked about that a little bit.
15 playable characters, I think.
Yeah, pretty loaded with X-Men, which I approve.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And you get some odd picks. Do you get Gambit in there? Gambit's in the mix.
Gambit, a pretty popular character in the late 90s and the early aughts.
Yeah, he was a cool motherfucker. He looks like the guy from Him.
Except he got red eyes and a trench coat.
Yeah, oh man. And he's fucking a trailer trash white girl.
Oh, it's true.
This is totally the thing. Yeah, for real. No, I love the game. It's you get two characters. They, of course, expanded it and made it even crazier with, you know, Marvel vs. Capcom 2. But the first game is still so much fun to play. I love it. You get, well, I think Chun-Li's in the mix, Ryu, Captain Commando's kind of a fun pick. Mega Man's in there, although he's garbage. Zangief is in there, also garbage, but still fun to play.
You see I was about to say see the Street Fighter representation, but you already mentioned Chun-Li and Ryu.
Yeah, Chun-Li and Ryu are there, and Zangief, and I think that might be it. The rest of the Capcom lineup is other characters from the world of Capcom. I'm trying to think of who else.
Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney.
No, so he's in 3.
of course he is.
So is Wesker. Wesker makes an appearance.
Yeah, I remember Wesker.
That's pretty sweet. And then I think from the Marvel side, you get... Morgan's in there. Morgan is a playable character.
From she's Capcom. Darksiders?
Yeah. Again, to that, I believe you got Wolverine and Spider-Man and the Hulk, Captain...
You get Iron Man in that version?
You get War Machine.
Yes.
Yeah, you get fucking War Machine. This game is great. It's so much fun. And then, of course, in Marvel Capcom 2, you get Iron Man, you get War Machine, you get fucking Bone Claw Wolverine and regular Wolverine.
You get, like, this explosion of character.
Yeah, you get this absolutely wild roster. But at any rate, it's a fun game, and instead of three, you only get two characters, and then you play... You get a tag-in, but it's a tag-in chosen from other things. So it'll be a tag-in of characters from other franchises. So, like, I think Tron Bonn is a tag-in, and she just shows up and blows a thing up. Or, like, Colossus is a tag-in, and he just kind of swoops through and just, like, puts a fucking elbow into them. I don't even know the guy's name, but it's the character from Ghouls and Goblins.
Arthur?
Arthur is a playable character. He just hops out and throws a couple of spears. So, what do you call those things? Those jousting
lances.
Lances, yeah. He throws some lances. This game is, like, fucking great. I love it.
Cool. So, speaking of the X-Men, there was some stuff going on in early 2000. And I've mentioned it in passing a couple of times when we do the retro show. There's an event called the 12. And the 12 is an event that's very centered around Apocalypse. And it takes place from about December to February. So I want to get to the actual event proper next time we do a retro show. I'm going to give you guys some background. Because there's a lot of background going on in this event.
So this is
going
to be the background episode in the next...
So it's the 12 days of Apocalypse?
Right. So, buckle in.
What day is the Golden Rings?
Don't worry about it.
Okay. It's literally going to be 12 people.
Yes, it is 12 people who are the 12. If you guys have any questions, give me the hand signal and I will stop.
So, stop. That's it.
We're going to reach way, way far back.
All right, have a good... It was a good show, guys.
We're going to reach way far back to the inception of the X-Men when Dr. Bolivar Trask invents the Sentinels. Okay? This guy who built the Sentinels had a daughter. His name is Tanya, who poetically turned out to be a mutant. So the guy who's building the mutant hunting machines has a mutant daughter. Her powers are time traveling as well as some telepathy and telekinesis. When her powers manifest at puberty, she actually gets her time travel powers manifest, and she gets lost in the time stream, which is this sort of Marvel idea for just kind of like this limbo state where you're just kind of lost in the void. She gets rescued from the time stream and pulled into the future, Cable's time, by Rachel Summers, the daughter of Cyclops and Jean from an alternate reality, and the sister of Cable.
What is Rachel's powers?
Rachel's powers are also telepathy, telekinesis, a very powerful telekinetic.
How does she get into the time stream to pull her out?
Stand by. For a time, she is thought to possess the Phoenix Force, but it's not actually the Phoenix Force. She's just super fucking powerful.
It's the Parrot Force.
Yeah, great. She gets pulled into the time stream during the Excalibur series because Captain Britain gets pulled into the time stream, and that has to do with his status as Captain Britain, Protector of England, and he's a character that is very involved in the multiverse. But he gets lost in the time stream, and she's able to rescue him by replacing him. And she eventually gets rescued from the time stream by Cable, who also has time travel capabilities through technology. So he ends up fighting a rival of his far into the future, and the rival of his also just happens to have Rachel there with him. There is a point in the X-Men timeline where Rachel is sent into the distant future before Cable is born, and she, the future that Apocalypse has taken over and turned into a hellscape, and she establishes the sort of order of resistance to Apocalypse. It's called the Ascani Clan.
What do you think is our bad guy's motivation here? Because whenever you hear about, like, the bad guy winning, he always turns the world into a hellscape. Like, yeah. What's their motivation? I mean, what does he do with this free time at this point? I get to sit on my nice throne and look at the barren wasteland of death and decay. Like, I don't see the...
When it comes down to it, Apocalypse's goal is to continue existing. And his vision of the world is just like this sort of like trial by combat. Only people who are capable of overcoming obstacles through brute force are worthy of any sort of a prominence.
So he's like Ray Lewis.
Except Apocalypse would have been driving the car.
Yeah, okay.
So, Rachel Summers ends up in the distant future to establish that spiritual order. At a certain point, they pull her back and bring her back into the present-day Earth 616 timeline. But there is this sort of understanding that eventually she does have to go back so that she continue to establish that that resistance to Apocalypse. That is her destiny is played out in the Cyclops and Jean limited run series, where they go to the future, help raise Cable, and that's when they find out that Rachel is also in the future, and she dies there of old age. So we know where her story ends. It is in the future. She dies of old age fighting Apocalypse. A paradox warning.
So Apocalypse is, in his quest to control the universe, is fighting an old woman?
Yes. Because he's also a very old man. He's actually raising Cable's clone in order to eventually take over Cable's clone's body and continue living there.
By the way, for what it's worth, this is a who's who of the best characters in Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Widely regarded as some of the best would be Sentinel, Magneto, Storm, Cable.
Mm-hmm.
All fucking machines.
Yep. All very powerful characters.
Well, we don't really care about that. We want them to fight in the game, not...
Yeah, that's true.
So, I'm going to...
And the NPCs. Yeah. They're just in the background.
Yeah. I'm going to let you guys know, of all the confusing time-traveling stuff right here, most of this has been at least resolved before the story of the 12. But there is a paradox warning here, and we're going to get to the paradox when we actually talk about the actual event. So, getting back to Tanya Trask, the daughter of the guy who built the Sentinels, she actually, when she goes into the future with Rachel Summers, she goes by the name Sanctity. That's kind of her mutant code name. So, after she's been in the future for a while, she travels back in time to try to prevent the rise of Apocalypse. So, if you prevent the rise of Apocalypse, you prevent the hellscape future, that's her goal. She went about this, trying to prevent his rise, by trying to operate under like the sort of a knowledge, the sort of mythology of the 12, which had become lost knowledge by the time she got to the future. It's 1,000 years in the future, so the 12 is kind of like this myth. So she went to program a master mold Sentinel, which her dad built, to try to seek out the 12, but she fucked up because she wasn't operating with good information.
Did we already discuss who the 12 are?
We have not, because at this point in the storyline of the 12, they don't know who the 12 is either. She did not accurately have all identities. So you fast forward a little bit. Just a side note, Sanctity was also the person who sent Cyclops and Jean to the 19th century to ensure that Nathaniel Essex becomes Sinister. She wanted to ensure Nathaniel Essex became Sinister, because without Sinister, there's no Madeline Pryor. Without Madeline Pryor, there's no Cable. She needed to ensure that Cable was going to be born and then sent into the future. So, speaking of Madeline Pryor, early in the X-Factor series, back in the mid-80s, Cyclops, who abandoned Madeline Pryor and Cable, his infant child, to go find Jean and join X-Factor, he goes back to Alaska out of guilt to try to find him and or his wife and his son. He has a run-in with Masterworld. She's gone. He has no idea where she went. He has no idea where Cable is. He has a run-in with Mastermold, who says that Cyclops is one of the 12. Cyclops is able to beat Mastermold. Mastermold survives. Mastermold also implicates that Xavier, Apocalypse, Jean, Storm, and Franklin Richards, the son of Reed Richards, are also possible members of the 12. And there are a couple of misleads about who the 12 actually are, because not all of the people I just mentioned there are actual members of the 12. Master Mold goes after the 12 again, because Master Mold is operating under the assumption that the 12 will eventually lead to a war of mutants against humans that mutants will win. So he's trying to, because he was programmed by Tanya Trask, Sanctity, to think this. So when Master Mold goes after Franklin Richards again, he then implicates that Danny Moonstar, Cannonball, and Psylocke are all members of the 12. Power Pack is able to defeat Master Mold and save Franklin Richards in that particular story. There's also a mislead later on in the X-Factor series where Apocalypse himself claims that he is one of the 12, and he also implicates all five of the original X-Men, Cyclops, Jean, Beast, Angel, Iceman, as well as Xavier, Storm, Cannonball again, and Cable as all possible members of
the 12. Nobody gives a shit about Cannonball.
Right. But there was a time, specifically in the mid-90s, where they were trying to make Cannonball a bigger deal than he ever deserved to be. There was a point where they were trying to make, like, claim that he was immortal. Like, he would recover from any, like, wound, or if he were killed, he would just resurrect himself. Which is, of course, ridiculous.
He just launches himself at shit.
Yep. So, after the events of Operation Zero Tolerance, where a Bastion was creating new Sentinels to destroy all mutants with the sanction of the U.S. government, Cyclops and Jean go to Alaska because Bastion put a bomb in Cyclops' chest. They had to do some quick surgery to get it out. He's incapacitated for a while. There they convene all original five X-Men. This is only important because it essentially takes two X-Men teams down to one because you've removed the original five. And the two X-books that are running at the time, Uncanny X-Men and X-Men, essentially become the same book. So events just kind of flip back and forth between the two of them. They're all telling the same story because you're left with seven or eight X-Men on the team, not enough to become two distinct teams. So we're going to pick up with those books in the mid-1999 when Juggernaut goes looking for another magic stone to give him more powers.
That's the thing he needed.
Yep. Because he needs some more power.
And this one goes up his ass.
I mean, could be. He never got a hold of it.
Okay, so we don't know.
It was fake. It was an ambush. He was being ambushed by this cult who were just trying to get his gem away from him. Gambit, Storm, and Kitty go to help him. They originally go in there because they were kind of trying to steal it before he does, because he doesn't need another stone. Fuck him. But they do eventually help him get his own stone, his own powers back, because better off in the hands of him than the crazy cult. At least they know that they can beat him up if they need to.
So, fun fact about Juggernaut and Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
Go on.
He has this thing, this input that you can do where he kind of charges up and he starts kind of flashing red. And the next hit that he has will deal double damage. Hmm. If you do the charge up and tag out, he will permanently keep that.
Oh, shit.
Oh, God.
So, from then on, including when you use him as a tag, he comes in dealing double damage.
Cool.
So, as long as you don't trigger that same attack again to get the double damage boost, he'll have it. Even if he's not flashing red, he'll still have it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Really broken if you can get that to work.
Yeah.
Is it hard to get that to work?
If you're playing an opponent that knows what they're doing, they're not going to let you breathe for half a second to let you do it. But if you can, it's fucking worth it.
So,
I'm surprised they never patched that.
in that PS2 game?
Yeah, in the PS2 game. I'm surprised they never patched it.
Yeah, in the arcade, just do an arcade exactly. Patch.
Marvel vs. Capcom drive around 2. Town.
Yeah, Marvel vs. Capcom 2 is so notoriously broken with how good some players are, how bad some other players are. Like, I'm doing a little bit of research on this, like, I realized that they even do weak list tournaments, meaning that the 10, what are considered the 10 best characters are banned from pick. Because there is like it's like 65 playable characters or something, so they basically take out the ones everyone uses, like I was saying, Sentinel, Storm, Magneto, Cable. Cyclops, Cable, get those guys out of there, they're too strong. So then you're left with supposedly all of the junk characters, but then all of them are still fucking amazing too, if you just use them the right way. I don't know, I digress. You got it.
Well, Capcom is generally pretty good at making a balanced fighter.
Yeah.
So of course, Juggernaut gets his gem back, but he actually gets more powerful. And he gets so powerful that he can start punching holes into other dimensions.
Wow.
So, of course, this is what he does. He starts punching holes into other dimensions. And Xavier, Storm, Wolverine, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Kitty Pryde, Gambit, and Marrow all get abducted into this other dimension, pretty much leaving Rogue at the mansion by herself, because the original five have gone off to Alaska. So they get abducted by these creatures who live in this other dimension, these aliens, and they're under attack from Juggernaut. Black Tom is there as well, because Black Tom follows Juggernaut everywhere.
God, that's a bad name.
Black Tom. But it made for some great jokes in the Deadpool 2 movie.
Yeah. Well, was his name Black Tom in the Deadpool 2 movie?
I think so. Mm. Anyway. Black Tom is the one who tells the aliens, like, hey, this my Juggernaut buddy is ruining your dimension. Go and get these guys, and they'll help you get rid of them. So Black Tom drags them all into his own Juggernaut drama. So they beat Juggernaut, and the aliens in the other dimension were like, okay, well, we'll get rid of you now. And they sent them off. Like, okay, send us back to exactly where we left. So the aliens were like, cool, we'll do that. And they sent them off to the Skrull homeworld. And the Skrull homeworld was, in their contemporary time, destroyed. It didn't exist anymore. So
they're floating in space and die.
So they, no. They get thrust back in time as well as space. So they're on the Skrull homeworld.
I'm going to admit, this is a little convoluted.
Like, what the...
Wait for it. So, they get to the Skrull homeworld, and they realize they have arrived there just as Galactus is about to destroy it. That's how the Skrull homeworld gets destroyed. Galactus just comes in there and has lunch. All right, so...
So now they got to fight off Galactus.
Right. Well, they yes. Xavier... Well, they can't fight off Galactus. Xavier,
fucking Galactus.
Xavier tries to reason with...
too big.
Xavier tries to reason with Galactus and say, like, hey, maybe you shouldn't kill everybody. And Galactus is like, whatever, bitch. And just goes and eats the planet. Before he eats the planet, though, they get to this part. They're on this part of the Skrull homeworld, which was maybe why the aliens from the other dimension were confused, where the Skrulls were planning an invasion of Earth. So you have all these Skrulls imitating all of these other Earth heroes, like Thor, some people who are already dead, like Warlock, Thunderbird, Captain America. You just have it's kind of an excuse to see like X-Men fighting these other characters because they do.
This sounds like Star Trek with the original Star Trek where they go to a planet and it's like exactly like Earth and they have to dress weird.
What this really reminds me of is there's a Parks and Rec thing where like Patton Oswalt.
Oh, the filibuster.
It sounds like you're telling this long-winded story about how you're going to tie together the entire Disney universe with Marvel or whatever in Star Wars. But go on.
This is a mess. Xavier can't convict Galactus. They escape the planet. This is also where Marrow gets her bones rearranged, where they're like all like just jutting out of her body in random places. They kind of become like a
sexy.
Yeah, more of a configuration. She like gets horns instead of just shards of bone.
Stop! I can only be so hard.
So they get on their ship, and Kitty Pryde, who apparently can pilot interstellar ships, so like, okay, I'm gonna set course for Earth, and I'm going to get us there. Just as we left, I'm going to put us in stasis. And they're like, okay, cool. So they do that. They actually arrive on Earth early. She's very efficient, apparently. They come out of stasis, and they like see Earth, and they see like the magnetic poles getting all fucked up. Like, oh shit, we got back like a week early, and this is when Magneto was holding the world hostage, going to fuck up the poles and kill everyone on the planet. And they just said, like, hey, don't do that. We'll give you the island of Genosha. So... they're like, well, we can stop him. We can like prevent all this from happening and prevent him from taking over a country. And they get like a panel and a half to sort of wrestle with, like, do we try to interfere with time like that? And then their just ship is like knocked off course by a rogue magnetic flare. And because their ship gets like damaged, it automatically puts them in stasis again. And they wake up a week later. It's like, well, shucks, we missed it. So they undercut their own drama there a little bit.
That's pretty dumb.
But what this does is like they're spending the past couple of issues here, three or four issues, kind of showing Xavier his own failures. You know, he's seeing Juggernaut, who is his stepbrother, who he's failed to control or reason with over and over again. When they're on the Skrull planet, he sees Thunderbird, who is an X-Man that died early on, so he had to face that failure again. He had to see himself failing at stopping Magneto from trying to reverse the poles and the planet abdicating to him and giving him a country. So Xavier's having a tough time And then he failed to reason with Galactus and has taken that kind of hard because all the Skrulls died. And he's even though it had already happened.
That's a lot to ask of one man, though.
Right. He's taken a lot of himself. And he's behaving like a dick because of it. So they when they land on Earth, they land on Muir Island. Nightcrawler, Colossus, and Kitty stay on Muir Island. They have a little adventure with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Duglock. Nothing super consequential happening there. They all end up on back at the X-Mansion where Xavier just gets super douchey. Him and Gambit get into it. They kind of have, like, the shouting match. Xavier says, like, fine, you can leave. And Gambit's like, I don't give a fuck if I leave or not. I'm just here for the... Well, how would they say it in the South? Or in Canada, I'm here for the cooter.
Okay, that's precisely what they would say. Oh, you said Rogue was in charge of things, so she's probably got, like, an above-ground pool now.
They probably put a big awning on the side of the mansion.
Right, there's a washer and a dryer out in the yard. Only one of them works.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And you wonder why it does.
So, Gambit takes off, and the entire team ends up splitting. They're all just fucking gone. They leave. Only Storm stays. Cyclops and Jean end up coming back. It's like, whoa, what the fuck is going on? They're like, he's being a dick. Like, well, we're leaving too then. So they all end up breaking up. People go their separate ways. A few of them stay together. We get some backstory on Marrow. She's hanging out with Colossus. You get some backstory because she was in the Morlock, the Mutant Massacre. She was a Morlock down in the tunnels when the Marauders came in, killed everyone. She was able to, a few of them were able to escape again to another dimension where time moved faster, which is why she's aged up. She was a child during the Mutant Massacre. Now she is a adult.
Convenient.
She and her and Colossus get abducted by his brother Mikhail, who's trying to resurrect Illyana in that alternate dimension. Of course he fails. They go back to reality. Mikhail is abducted by we don't know who yet. Nightcrawler has a little adventure. He bumps into Polaris, who's being followed and doesn't know why or by who. And we haven't really seen her since the original run of X-Factor ended when Havoc died. So, first time she's popped up since then. Kitty and Rogue.
Polaris is...
Magneto's daughter. Magneto powers. Green
hair.
Okay.
Okay.
Kitty and Rogue have a run-in with Mystique and Sunfire.
How many kids does this guy have?
Three.
Okay.
Three children that made it to adulthood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
until two of them got, like, what was it, retconned?
Retconned, yeah. They have something to do with the High Evolutionary now. I don't know much about what's going on with them.
Stupid.
Kitty and Rogue have a run-in with Mystique and Sunfire, where Sunfire thinks that Mystique is trying to conduct some sort of espionage in Japan. Kitty discovers...
Who has time for that?
Right.
Who's got time for espionage in Japan when, like...
You know, all of this is happening. The important thing there is, like, we get reminded that Sunfire is a person who exists, and Kitty discovers one of Destiny's diaries. Destiny is the precog that died back on Muir Island. Wrote some diaries predicting the future. That turns into a storyline later where they're trying to track down the rest of the diaries so no one else can get their hands on them and know what happens.
I was reading up on her. Her name's Irene Adler.
It is.
The fuck?
Yeah.
That's a name of someone else. That's the woman, that's the love interest from fucking Sherlock.
Oh, right.
Sherlock Holmes has a thing for her.
I wonder if she's also in the stories, in the novels, the original source material.
Maybe, maybe not.
Because I wouldn't put it past Chris Claremont to be like, hey, I like that name and I like that character. I'm going to go ahead and steal that.
So much of what you're describing, I just imagine Chris Claremont in, like, this giant, like, Hollywood studio with, like, palm trees behind him, feet up on the desk twirling a pen. As he's just, blah, to, like, 20 people with notepads. And they're like, oh, we'll fucking do this, man.
One of the fucked up things is a lot of this, like, all of the setup that I mentioned before with Rachel Summers and Tanya Trask, like, that all was Chris Claremont, but once we move past, like, once we move to the part where I was talking about Juggernaut, that's other people. Other people are having to finish out this event. Like, all this backstory started in the mid-80s, and then it doesn't pay off until we get the event of the 12 in 2000. This is, like, something that's kind of been on the back burner for 14 years.
You've got six principal writers.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Sure is. Amazing that they're able to make something semi-coherent here. It turns out they weren't, but there's this parade of returning characters that you might notice that just kind of remind you that they exist. Polaris, Sunfire, Mikhail Rasputin.
Who the frick is that?
Living monolith.
Colossus' brother.
The living monolith. He has a brother?
Yeah, and a sister. Sister's dead. His entire family's dead except for Mikhail. Because Ilyana died of the legacy virus, and his parents were killed by the state of Russia.
Is this where she's dead, or is she coming back at some point?
She's dead. They do resurrect her later. Like she will be back, but not for a little while yet. Speaking of the living monolith, Ryan, in space, you might remember from several months back we talked about Bishop. He got abandoned in space. He's hanging out with Deathbird, who is the sister of the Empress of the Shi'ar Empire. She double-crosses him. They're trying to get him back to Earth. She double-crosses him.
Classic Deathbird.
Yeah, she's not to be trusted. Which is, it's a weird double-cross, because she like...
We're abandoned in space together.
Yeah.
Let me fucking take it out on you.
Hits him over the head with a gun or something. Like, really? No, I'm done with you. And then she just puts him on Earth. Like, it's so fucking weird. Like, why don't you just, like, play out the charade until you got him there? Like, all right, have a good one. Like, why bother going through the whole, like, this is a double cross? He never needed to know. He didn't have to know.
Again, this is one of those times where one of the writers in the room was, like, going to speak up and say something, and they were like, shh, Chris is talking.
Deathbird is headed to Earth anyway because she double-crossed him on this weird planetoid that they come across, and it actually turns out to be this sarcophagus of the living monolith, who is a character I don't know much about. He is a mutant, and he's a very powerful mutant. He's able to like change his size and his very superhuman strength.
Must be very popular with the ladies.
I think he's also associated in some way with the Savage Land, but I'm not sure about that. He's a character who I don't remember the last time he came up in an X-Men book. It might have been in, like, the 70s. And I think he also popped up with the Avengers every once in a while.
He is from Cairo, Egypt.
Oh, okay.
Ahmet Abdul. And it says here, a big highlight about him is that he killed his own daughter.
Oh, what a monster.
Yeah, jeez. What a real sweetheart here.
Not a good dude.
Yeah.
But apparently, at some point, the Avengers hurled him into space. Deathbird finds him and brings him back.
That seems like it'd be, like, their solution to everything. Mm. Just hurl into space.
Because she in some form, is in cahoots with Apocalypse. I think she wants something from him, some sort of power, probably to overthrow the Shi'ar Empire and take the throne for herself.
Because Apocalypse wants to know what's going on with this espionage in Japan.
Right. He's,
he someone likes, on the inside.
He likes to stay abreast of all the situations around the world. Very, very involved in foreign politics.
It's fucking Tamagotchis, man.
So she delivers the living monolith to Apocalypse, who, of course, then double-crosses her and turns her into the Horseman of War.
Wow.
So, after the X-Men team splits up, when Xavier says, everyone get the fuck out, Wolverine, Cyclops, Jean, Angel, Cable, and Nate Grey are on an adventure to rescue some kids from the some sort of assassin that has been hounding people for a few issues now. They've had this run-in with this guy. He's got a couple of scimitars. He wears a scarf around his face. They have no idea who he is, but he's kicked their ass a couple of times in a fight now. So they go to rescue these kids, have a run-in with him. Wolverine is murdered. He is dead on a slab. They get him back to the mansion. Everyone has a good cry because Wolverine is dead. All right. And
I thought that sounded possible.
So what does Xavier do? He uses this as an opportunity to start a fight. He just pits everyone against each other, and you just see all these X-Men just duking it out. And then, of course, it all turns out to be this ruse. It's this psychic ruse, this exercise that he's doing to where he can find out if there are any imposters throughout the X-Men. Because it turns out Wolverine on the slab there isn't Wolverine. It's a Skrull. Remember back when I was talking about how they were in space, got back to Earth, magnetic wave, knocked them off course, undercut their own drama? Well, what had happened there was when they get knocked off course again, somehow Apocalypse knew that they were going to be there in that spaceship, sent his Skrulls up, abducted Wolverine, replaced him, and we find out that Wolverine is that guy with the scimitars and the scarf around his face because he's become the Horseman of Death.
Well.
So after he was abducted...
Wow.
What the fuck is this?
So what's, I like that I'm reading along in this thing, and you've gone through the first paragraph of this whole giant...
We haven't even gotten to the actual event yet.
Oh, man.
So,
they haven't even had the birthday party yet.
Yep. Oh, you okay, Sherlock?
This is half the podcast right here. Holy hell.
I got two sentences left. I got two more lines of notes here, and then we are going to call it...
If people are still listening.
After Wolverine was abducted on the spaceship and replaced by a Skrull, he gets taken to Apocalypse Lair, where he gets thrown into this trial by combat with Sabretooth. And Sabretooth, a little while back, had actually had adamantium grafted onto his bones because he didn't want to be outdone by Wolverine. And if you remember, Wolverine had the adamantium ripped off of his bones by Magneto. He's got the bone claws right now. So they have this trial by combat. Winner is going to become the Horseman of Death. And Wolverine's like, I don't want to be the Horseman of Death. And Apocalypse is like, well, you either fight him or, you know, we just kill you. And Wolverine's like going like through his inner monologue like he does. He's like, well, I don't want to be the Horseman of Death, but I know that I'm pretty sure that I can fight him off. I can resist the influence of Apocalypse. But Sabretooth doesn't even want to resist. Sabretooth is going to like run amok and kill a ton of people, so I got to beat him. So they fight. Wolverine beats Sabretooth. And of course, is not able to resist Apocalypse.
In trial by combat. As Rudy Giuliani would suggest.
Rudy Giuliani was there.
Ray Lewis was as well, just saying that.
Playing the role of Caliban, who was the Horseman of Pestilence at that point.
Yeah.
Wolverine wins, and when Wolverine wins, he's like, cool, you're the Horseman of Death now. Right this way to my operating room. They rip the adamantium off of Sabretooth, put it back on Wolverine. He's got his claws back now.
Like, jeez.
And next month, we'll talk about the 12.
I still don't even know who the 12 fucking are.
The 12 are... Ryan, do you have the list?
Yeah.
I'm gonna try
Not who they actually are. Like, what's the deal with the 12?
Okay, so first I'm going to tell you who they are. It's Cyclops... Let me know if I miss any. Cyclops, Jean, Iceman, Storm, Sunfire, Xavier, Magneto, Polaris, Cable, Bishop, The Living Monolith... I missed one. Who'd I miss?
They're not in that order, so it's difficult to say. I think the one you... Did you say Professor X?
I did.
Jean Grey is not one of them, unless she goes by some other moniker.
Phoenix?
Oh, Phoenix, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got Magneto, Polaris, Storm. Did you miss Sunfire?
I did Sunfire.
Iceman, Cyclops, Phoenix, of course. Cable, Bishop, Rasputin,
Mikhail Rasputin.
Professor X, and our boy, Living Monolith. You skipped the part here, though, in the story where Cyclops pretends to be Polaris.
And has sex
with a dozen people.
I haven't gotten to that point yet.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
That's actually going to be in the event of
which is a slow Tuesday for him.
Yeah.
He gets around that Cyclops. But so the 12, to your point, Wes, because they don't know who the 12 are yet. They're still like operating in the center.
Xavier reveals that they are listed in Destiny's Diary.
Yes. So they are... people that Apocalypse is trying to gather together in order to augment his own powers and then get a new host body. And he's going to try to put himself into the host body of Nate Grey, who is...
So everyone looks around at the room and like, why is Sunfire here? Like, I get everybody
when
else.
When did you get here? Oh, I was here like checking out Mystique, because she was doing some espionage in Japan.
He's just over there eating like some cake or something. Just in the room. He's just milling about.
So that's the 12. That's the lead up to the 12.
Well, God damn, what the fuck? Alright.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zero regard. This movie is just so fucking loose with everything. Or this whole story is so loose with everything. That,
right.
Wow.
Wow, wow, wow.
And a lot
wow,
of...
Wow, wow, wow. Wow, wow, wow. Wow, wow, wow. Wow, wow, wow. We need to stop watching that guy's video.
How difficult do you think it's going to be to get out of this, right?
It's like, oh, barely an inconvenience.
It's super easy. Barely an inconvenience.
So, next up is the official show.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about some new releases to talk about. Some games coming out in the month of February that will be interesting.
Yeah, this will be good.
I think we'll have some gospel or gossip that we'll be able to play this time.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, get some nice rumors flowing around.
I get to bury one of your favorite games.
Oh, that'd be fun.
This is going to be wonderful.
Oh, actually, that'd be a...
That'd be a mini show.
I suppose we could talk about it.
Yeah.
Say we're doing on time.
Okay.
But here's the thing, you're gonna trash Xenoblade. I'm gonna let you have your time. I've said enough about Xenoblade. I love that game. I will not argue with you.
Okay.
I'll just let you say your piece.
You say that now, but 5 minutes in you're gonna be like,
I'm like scribbling notes, these like steam coming off my pad, and then like at the end of like after the credits of the show, I'm gonna come like, okay, I got some things to say here.
You're gonna edit it out and just put fart noises over everything I say.
Anytime you say bad, is it gonna be Pikachu screaming?
Yeah.
But then we'll start it all back up with the Pokemon show in February. Yeah. That'll be that.
Sounds fair.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Adios, amigos.
So long.
Muchachos. Buenos noches. Thank you.